Hey, it's Scott Petrek with another episode of the Brown Zone Zone Coverage Podcast. Since we talked last week, the legendary Jim Brown died at age 87. The Browns also began OTAs, and I watched practice Wednesday. Here to discuss, as always, is Dave Chudowski of GO, the WKYC Morning News. Hey, Chud.
Scott, how's it going?
Good, good. Looking forward to the long weekend.
Yeah, it is. It's nice nice to have it here. And I think the cool thing about it, it's a long weekend where you got the weather cooperating. It's going to be in the 80s next week, 70s this weekend. I feel like we've turned that corner, you know. I know it's been a little bit chilly, but, you know, we've turned that corner and we're ready for the summertime. So the unofficial start to summer, which means, you know, it's crazy. I was thinking about this. I was doing some yard work yesterday. When you hit Memorial Day weekend, it's kind of when I start thinking, you know, it's the unofficial start to summer, then Labor Day, and then yet is the end of summer kind of right before football season, but it flies by. I mean, before you know it, we're going to be breaking down Browns games.
I know. It's crazy, Chud. Like, all of a sudden, you know, I was talking to my mom a couple weeks ago. She's like, I can't believe it's May. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And then all of a sudden, I'm looking at the calendar and I'm going, it's right now we're less than 2 months from the start of Browns training camp, right? So, because that's like July 22nd-ish. So it's less than 2 months when, you know, my life kicks into everyday nonstop Browns, Browns, Browns. And so it's, you know, that's not a lot of time to squeeze in patios and as much golf as I can. So I needed to slow down for the next 2 months.
Yeah, no question. You definitely want to enjoy the summer. Let's start out with this, though, and you mentioned it off the top and got word pretty much right after we taped our last pod. Obviously, condolences to Jim Brown's family and the entire Browns family and Browns fans mourning the loss of Jim Brown, 87 years old. Scott, obviously, everyone knows that this happened, but I think, you know, what would you like to say in regards to the great Jim Brown here today?
Yeah, I mean, it's just so much, Chud, right? You know, I was talking to one of the other writers at OTAs, and he's like, you know, do I need to say arguably the greatest Brown of all time? And I was like, and I had my boss, you know, once told me, unless it's a sure thing, right? Like, should always kind of throw in some kind of qualifier. So I said, yeah, it's probably a good idea. But I've been thinking about that. And, you know, in my mind, he's clearly the greatest Cleveland Brown of all time. I think you can make an argument about Otto Graham just because he was a quarterback, went to 10 straight title games in 10 seasons, right? Like, there's an argument to be made there. But to me, it's Jim Brown. And, you know, you do all this research. We all know about Jim Brown, right? But when he dies and you relook at all the stats, it's just amazing, right? The 104 yards per game rushing is the most in NFL history. He still leads the Browns in rushing yards, rushing touchdowns, total touchdowns. You know, his 5.2 yards a carry is at the top in NFL history for, you know, a running back. It's like just him on the field is really. It's just non-comparable, you know, when you look at his place in franchise history and NFL history when it comes to running backs, right? Like, I think he's the greatest running back of all time. And if you have a discussion about the greatest NFL players of all time, I know now it's Tom Brady, right? I think there's a consensus that Tom Brady, with all the Super Bowls and how long he played, the longevity, the sustained success, I think most people call him the greatest player in NFL history. Jim Brown is in that discussion. Jerry Rice is in that discussion. And it's probably those three guys, right? And I think from, you know, 1965 was Brown's last season. I think until Jerry Rice became Jerry Rice, right? There was a 40-year period where it was Jim Brown. And he wasn't really challenged as the greatest player of all time. And then there was a movement toward Jerry Rice because he was so good at receiver. And then there was Tom Brady. So, you know, I think that encapsulates a little bit of just his legacy on the field. You know, you watch the highlights. I think, you know, my lead for his obituary was Superman, because that's what he looked like. And I think what he felt like to other players he was going against. on the field was Superman. So, well, I'll clip it there because I think there's more to him. There's obviously way more to his person. But just on the field, that's what jumps out to me. What about you, Judd?
Yeah. Well, you're talking about a 9-time Pro Bowler. He played 9 seasons. I mean, right. He could have played so much longer, and that's what's incredible about him. And, you know, you put the word arguably when it comes to the Browns. I guess you have to put that word in there maybe, but when you put him in the fact that he, I guess, arguably would go in the front of in the NFL history, yeah, you know, yeah, of entire league, not just the Browns, arguably the best player in NFL history with the couple of guys that you just mentioned. So I totally, you know, understand. I think what stands out for me is just how we're not just talking about an NFL player. We're talking about a guy that meant so much more for what he stood for and spoke out for. And also all the movies he was in. Yeah. I mean, he, you know, he wasn't just a football player. I mean, you know, people who didn't even just follow football knew who he was. So, you know, the guy was just, he was a presence as well. And, you know, obviously, you know, there's other things about him that, you know, we don't need to discuss that, you know, have been brought up in the past too. But I just think when you think of Jim Brown, so many people talk about different stories they had. Scott, do you have one that stands out just from being in Berea and seeing him as many times as you did? Is there anything that stands out to you? You know, did you ever ride the elevator with him, or just have anything that, you know, you could share?
Yeah, I got 3 real quick, Chud. Just it's the first time you're around him, right? And I am too young to have seen Jim Brown play. But, you know, my dad wasn't, my uncles weren't, right? So when you grow up here, you hear all about it. And I know how much he means to this community, especially the sports community. So the first time you're around him, whether, you know, you see him in a golf cart at practice, but I remember, and I couldn't tell you what day it was or anything, and it probably happened more than once, but walking into Brown's headquarters, kind of trailing him in and him holding the door open for me and thinking to myself, you know, I know plenty of people that could not imagine walking through the same door as Jim Brown, right? And that might seem silly, right? He's just another human being, right? But that would have deep meaning for a lot of people I know. And I think that carries on for the whole region, right? And maybe even the whole sporting world. If you're walking through a door and Jim Brown holds it open for you, you think twice, right? So I had that moment. And, you know, it's just, hey, thanks, Mr. Brown. You know, like, it's, you know, it's just you're walking into work, but it's something different because it's Jim Brown. I had an interview, and I don't remember exactly what the reason was. It was, there was something going on in the sports world. It was a social justice, racial equality, something like that, a big story in the sports world. And it was me, Tom Withers from the Associated Press, and Pat McManaman, who spent time working at the Akron-Beacon Journal and worked for the Browns for a while, worked at ESPN. And it was just the 3 of us in this little hallway. And Chud, you've been in Berea, so you got that media room, and then there's that little hallway just outside the media room. And it was the 3 of us and Jim Brown. So we're in a tiny area. It's almost like a closet-like area. And we're talking about the significant issue of the day. And, you know, you don't get a whole lot of 3-on-1 interviews with Jim Brown. At least I didn't. So that one stands out for me. And then, you know, just a kind of a counter to that, I was at the convention center, and I forget, it was like a big Browns event, and I forget what it was, but the big thing, Jim Brown was there. I'm backstage, and I approach him, and I think this is pretty early in LeBron's career, but I wanted to talk to Jim Brown about LeBron and him, you know, like the presence of him and being a superstar, and I thought Jim Brown had great insight. And I approach him, and he just wanted no part of me that day. You know, maybe he's in a bad mood. Maybe I phrased my question wrong, but I was getting these like one word answers where finally I was like, okay, thanks, Mr. Brown. Like, you know, cause it wasn't going anywhere. And then he gets on stage, gets a similar question and gives a great answer. So it was just one of those, you know, like it's a journalist kind of story, right? Like it's not, I don't never call it a grudge. I mean, people have bad days, whatever. But it was just funny. Like I'm talking to Jim Brown one-on-one and it was one of the worst interviews I ever had. So just from a personal level, those are the ones that stand out to me. I mean, you were around the team. Chud, did you have any moments with Jim?
You know, I've thought about that, and I don't have any, you know, one-on-one moments with him. Just the kind of being, like you said, you know, you and I are similar age, and I didn't get to watch him play either. But just growing up a diehard Browns fan and knowing the history of him, and just being, you know, inches, feet apart from him at any Browns interview session or event that he was at, seeing him on game day at the stadium, walking by in the tunnel. You know, I used to do sideline reporting for the Browns, and, you know, so I would, but I never had a conversation with him, a personal one. It was all just in the work type environment, but I just remember always that feeling, and it doesn't happen often, Scott. I think you're the same way. I think in this business, we get desensitized to a lot, but he's one of the few that took away that feeling of feeling desensitized, and you just were like, wow, that's Jim Brown, and, you know, you're around greatness. So that's how I always felt. But unfortunately, or I maybe unfortunately is not the word, but I never got a chance to, you know, sit down and have a conversation with him.
Yeah. But you're right, Sean. I was at the bar after softball the other day, and I've known my buddy for, Jesus, it's probably 28 years I've known this guy. And he's like, did you ever interview Jim Brown? And I'm like, yeah, you know, more than once. And he was taken aback by it, right? Like, it feels routine to me to some level, right? And we talked about how special it is, but yeah, it gets to a point where it does seem routine. And he's like, oh my God, like, he didn't know that. And it really meant something to him that I had talked to Jim Brown, right? And interviewed Jim Brown. So it just kind of reminds you, if you get caught in your daily grind, that it means something to people, right? Just
I was in press conferences with them, you know, mm-hmm. but that I, you know, I don't know if that doesn't really count when you have, you know, that many people, you know, right. That's not personable.
No, but I mean, it's interesting. And this is obviously off topic, but when I think about people I've interviewed, like, I kind of consider Tiger and LeBron, but I've never been one-on-one with those guys. I've been in a little group with Tiger Woods. You know, I think with Jack, I've been with a handful of people, with Jack Nicklaus down at the Memorial. Maybe bigger than a handful, but not a ton of people, you know? So it's, you know, it's one of those things where, okay, is it box A or B? But it's still cool to have said that, right? To be in those settings with people that are in that list of greatest of all time, right? Like, I talked to Annika Sorenstam 2 weeks ago, and it was me and one other guy talking to Annika Sorenstam. She's probably the greatest female golfer in history, right? So, like, there's something cool to that, a cool element to this job, right? You know, to wrap it up on Jim Brown, and you touched on it, Judd, and I just think we can't have a Jim Brown discussion without talking about just the complexity of his life and legacy. And on the positive side is the actor, right? And, you know, I remember Dirty Dozen, watching it as a kid, and how cool that was, right? And then he went on to act forever. And I remember it was like a decade ago, I'm flipping through channels one night, it's late at night, and I see Jim Brown in some movie I never heard of. So he was acting as long as he could act, because I think he really did love that love doing it, love kind of the medium of acting. You know, and he had a long career doing that. The civil rights part of it. And I'm reading a book by Dave Zirin about Jim Brown, and he gets into it, and I'm not through it yet, but that's complicated too, because he was a Malcolm X guy and really didn't agree with a lot of Martin Luther King Jr.'s approaches. Like, he didn't think the march was, like, worth anything, right? Like, that kind of activism. So, you know, I don't know if it's right to say he's a civil rights leader, but he was certainly active in the civil rights era, and fought for Black equality, right? That's something he really believed in. But that's just another level to, like, the complexity of Jim Brown, because it's not black and white, you know? Like, you can't just say, okay, civil rights icon, without mentioning this, and without mentioning that he met with Donald Trump, and he feuded with Congressman John Lewis. Like, there's, you know, they disagreed on things late in his life. Like, he's just a fascinating guy who's incredibly smart, right? It's an incredible athlete. We didn't even mention lacrosse Hall of Fame, played basketball at Syracuse, ran track at Syracuse, right? Like, It's just this larger than life persona. And then you have the, you know, then you have the violence against women thing that must be acknowledged, but is in this totality of this, again, just larger than life person that meant so much to so many people.
Yeah, no question. All right, let's move on to present day Browns and OTAs. This past week, you got to watch practice on Wednesday, correct? Wednesday?
Yep.
So real quick before we get into, you know, what you saw, Myles Garrett, Nick Chubb, Betonio not there. They are voluntary. That's always – we always question that, though, how loosely that word or strictly that word is used. Let's just get it out of the way. Any, you know, any big deal, the fact that they're not there?
I don't think so, John. And there were people that would disagree with me, but I don't think it is. You know, I think practice in May has its value. I think it's not super important. I think, you know, I think it's interesting and noteworthy that they're not there. I think you could argue those are the three best players on the team. Should they be there? In a perfect world, I would say yes. And I don't know what's going on in each person's life, right? So maybe there's specific reasons that they're not there. But if we assume that it's just they're not coming to voluntary thing, and Joe Betonio hasn't done it the last couple of years, I think that's – it could might even be a nod to his friendship with J.C. Treader, head of the union. You know, J.C. has said, hey, we're spending too much time in team facilities in the offseason. We should curtail it. But Joe Betonio not being here is not going to affect him one iota when the season starts. And I feel the same way about Nick Chubb and Myles Garrett. And, you know, I don't know if they've been to any of the offseason program. I know Myles has been, was at the start of the offseason program. So at least he's been in Berea since it started. I can't say, I don't know that for sure about Chubb or Betonio. But on the field, I don't think it affects them. If you want to talk about leadership and setting a culture, we could have that argument, I suppose. But to me, I don't think it's important. You know, if Deshaun Watson weren't there, I think that would be significant, especially because, you know, it's he didn't play. You know, he missed so much time last year. It's new receivers. There's timing and chemistry. There's not timing and chemistry for Betonio, Chubb, or Myles Garrett. And you can argue that Garrett's leadership would be missed as they – kind of rebuild this defense with all these new pieces, Jim Schwartz. And I understand that argument. I just kind of disagree with it. And I don't think it's a big deal. And I do want to say in a perfect world, it would be great for everybody to be there. I'm sure the coaches, I know the coaches want everyone to be there. I just don't think it's that big a deal.
All right, let's talk about some guys that you got a chance to talk to. Let's start out with Za'Darius Smith. And, you know, you look at his past with how many sacks he has in his career. And was it three Pro Bowls in eight seasons? But I guess, Scott, he was doing that as an outside linebacker in a 3-4 scheme, right? So there was a lot of talk this week about what he could do now in a 4-3. Is that right?
Yeah. To me, Chad, that was the most interesting part of the Za'Darius Smith interview, and there were a lot of interesting parts to it. But the first thing he talked about when he was discussing his excitement about coming to the Browns in the trade with the Vikings is that now he gets to put his hand in the dirt and play strictly 4-3 end. When he did that in high school, he said he did it in college, but since he's been in the NFL, he's played 3-4 outside linebacker. And, you know, this might be getting in the weeds a little bit. In the lines have been blurred in recent NFL, you know, in the past 5-10 years in the NFL between 4-3 and 3-4 schemes. And there's some people that tell you it doesn't matter. I don't agree with that. I think it does matter. And there is a difference between 4-3 and a 3-4 linebacker. At 3-4 linebacker, you have some responsibilities to drop in coverage. You stand up a lot of times off the edge, as opposed to putting that hand in the ground, like he said. Those are differences. And then not to mention the scheme itself is different. But that's why nowadays there's a lot of talk of edge rushers. So when the trade was made, I referred to him a lot as an edge rusher and pass rusher because he played outside linebacker. But now he's going to be a defensive end And he's got the size. He's 6'4", 270. He's almost like almost the exact same size as Myles Garrett. Now, their bodies aren't exactly the same, but the measurements are real close. So I think he obviously can handle it physically. I think he can set an edge in the run game, but he's looking forward to having, I think it's simpler to be a 4-3 defensive end because you don't have to drop in coverage, because you're just going forward. And that's multiplied in a Jim Schwartz scheme, because all he wants to do is attack. He doesn't want his defensive linemen thinking. And I think Za'Darius Smith is really looking forward to that change. And it's interesting that it happens this late in his career, that he's never been a strictly 4-3 defensive end before. And then he was talking about some other stuff. You know, he got asked about being defensive player of the year and if that really matters to him. And he said, it'd be nice. It's on his bucket list, but he's more concerned about, you know, the team winning the division. He really was strong about how important it is to win the division, right? So guys talk about the Super Bowl. The first step is winning the division. And he's done that every stop of his career. He did it with the Ravens. He won multiple division titles with the Packers. And then last year in his only season in Minnesota, the Vikings won the NFC North. So, you know, the Browns have never won the NFC North. The Browns have never won an AFC North title, and it's staggering, right? We can talk about all the stats about how, right? I mean, there's a million bad Brown stats, right? 0-16, 1-31, and you probably can't top that. But the one that boggles my mind every time I write it is the AFC North was formed in 2002. The Browns have never won a division title. Like, it's just staggering. So if they can do that, if Za'Darius Smith can continue – his streak of winning division titles, you know, that'd be remarkable. It'd be super noteworthy, but that's what his focus is. It's say, let's win a division title. Then we can try to go in a Super Bowl. And I thought he said Scott, all the right things. I thought he said all the right things about putting himself behind the team.
Yeah. All right. You're forgetting also Brown's never been to a Super Bowl and haven't been to the AFC Championship game since 89. But
yeah, those are big ones.
Salt on wounds. Sorry. But going back to Za'Darius, I want to comment on what you just said before. Surprising that he's never been in the 4-3 or in his career. Like you would think that a defensive coordinator would have, you know, thought about that, or that he would have told somebody, or like what? How has this not happened before?
Yeah, you know what I think happens, Judd, is he gets drafted by the Ravens, and he's kind of not a tweener, but he can do both. Right, he can play 3-4, he can play 4-3. And they run a 3-4 scheme. So he gets in that scheme, he spends 4 years there, and then when he gets to free agency, he winds up with another 3-4 team, right? So it just kind of perpetuates itself, and then you need somebody to break that chain, and that's what the Browns have done. And I'm sure when he was in free agency, the couple of times he was, I'm sure 4-3 teams looked at him, right? And like I said, physically he can do it. So I don't think there's any reason why, like, I don't think he was pigeonholed as a 3-4 guy. You know, like TJ Watt, right, with the Steelers. He's a 3-4 outside linebacker. I think you could play him at 4-3 end. And I think he'd excel, obviously, as a pass rusher. He's awesome. Now, you know, would he need to get any bigger to handle the run? I don't know. You know, I think that's a interesting debate. You know, Obo Okoronkwo, who the Browns have, he's a similar size to TJ Watt, and the Browns are going to play him at end. So, you know, there's different guys you can, you know, different body types you can play at positions. I just think it's kind of circumstance in where you wind up to start your career. Because, you know, the fact is, when Myles Garrett came out, he did drills at the combine as an outside linebacker, right? Like, that's what they do with edge rushers, the NFL. The scouts look at guys here and there. And yes, Myles is incredibly gifted. But he would be, in my opinion, miscast as a 3-4 outside linebacker. So that's why I think it was important when the Browns hired Joe Woods. He went to a 4-3 when he arrived as coordinator, even though he had history in a 3-4. And I think it was important that Jim Schwartz ran a 4-3 as opposed to bringing in a guy like Vic Fangio, who would switch to a 3-4, because I think Myles is perfectly suited to be 4-3 end. Not that he couldn't adapt and be and play 3-4 linebacker. I just don't think it maximizes his talent level. And I kind of feel the same way about Za'Darius Smith.
Yeah. Let's talk about Juan Thornhill now.
Yeah, right, real quick, one more thing. Yeah. One more thing on Smith. He said his knee's fine. He had a knee contusion in the middle last year, and it really affected his production over the second half of the season. Says it's fine. And just this last thing, he was really blunt about his contract situation, right? That was one of the reasons the trade happened. The Vikings have salary cap issues. Smith was not happy with his contract, and he was kind of talking about that. And then and tying in with the knee, he said the reason he played despite the knee pain last year, and he fought through it and he played, but he only had one. He had a half a sack over his last 8 games. He said he was getting $200,000 just to dress. Like, that was part of his contract, was every game you suit up, you get $200,000. And he said, you would suit up for $200,000 if you could, right? So it was just, you know, and I know that happens across the league, right? But he just kind of said something that usually remains in the background. And so I think you could say, oh, yes, he's tough and he played through it. But there is a component of, hey, I'm playing through it because I'm not going to give up $200,000 if I can show up and go play. And that's what he did for the last half of last season.
Oh, so he was playing through the injury, even though he probably shouldn't have been?
Yeah, I think some rest might have helped him.
Yeah.
But he played through it. And part of that stopped the team, but part of it is because he didn't want to leave the money on the table.
So that was the top thing I wanted to talk about was Za'Darius. I felt that that kind of stood out to me the most. The second thing that stood out to me was Juan Thornhill and his comments about the fans. He used to play with the Chiefs, and he basically said that Chiefs fans are cocky. They just come there every Sunday or whatever day it is that they just expect to win, and that the Chiefs players feed off of that. And he thinks that, you know, he wants the Browns fans' support and that he wants positive energy. What do you think about that?
John, I'm fascinated by this topic. And I posted a story this morning about Thornhill and his discussions. Because he'd gone on Twitter and he said, I've been here only 3 weeks, too much negativity. We're going to win this year. We need you behind us. I'm paraphrasing. So he talked about that on Wednesday. And the reason I'm fascinated by it is I understand you get this fresh perspective, right? You come from Kansas City where he was there for 4 years. They won 2 Super Bowls and went to 3. Yeah, the fans are going to be optimistic, right? Like,
yeah,
it follows, right? Success, you're optimistic when you've had success and you're confident when you've had success. You come here and he's got that mindset. And plus you have the professional athlete mindset, your confidence in yourself, right? You walk with this, a lot of people, a lot of the athletes carry themselves with a swagger because they're so good and they've reached the ultimate in their profession. And you come to Cleveland, no history of success. You get a fan base that's been jilted so many times, had its heart broken. You know, you got the move. You know, we mentioned all the crappy stats, right? We just went over that. And there's a little bit of a culture shock in a kind of butting heads between, hey, we're going to win, and yeah, we've heard that before, right? Because Juan Thornhill's not the first guy to arrive in town and talk big about what's coming up, right? Or even be here and talk big about what's coming up. And fans have been jilted by that. I mean, you don't have to go back far, right? 2021, they're coming off a playoff season. They regressed. 2019, there was so much excitement after 2018 with Baker and Freddie Kitchens. In 2019, they regressed and, you know, the GM and coach get fired. And we can go down the list, 2007 to 2008, right? Like 2002 to 2003. Like, anytime there's been a blip of success, there's been a regression the next year. So I just find it really interesting. And, you know, I don't have a horse or a dog in this fight, and I'm not picking sides, but I get it from Juan Thornhill's perspective, right? Like, it doesn't do any good to have the people who are supporting you the most doubting you, right? Like, I get it. And I believe in positivity and optimism, so I understand that. I also understand the fans who are like, hey, you haven't experienced what we've experienced for the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years, right? So try not to talk to, like, try not to lecture us, right? You don't know what we've been through. So I get it. And the last thing I want point I want to make, and I'm really curious to hear your opinion, Chud, because you're a fan, right? Is I see both sides in my group of guys I hang out with that are big Browns fans. You have the unbridled optimism. They're going 17-0. They're going to win the Super Bowl, right? And then you got the guys on the same text thread that are, they stink. They're, you know, the first incompletion of the game, they're going to lose, right? Like, I see that in real time, whether it's on text or on Twitter. And I just think it's incredibly interesting, the psychology of the Cleveland Browns fan.
Scott, it is unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, I have the same exact situation with my buddies. I have a Browns fan who just, no matter what, through all thick and thin since 1999, this is going to be the year. They got this guy. They got that guy. This is going to turn it around. You know, it's not their fault. This or, and then you have the other guy that is just so pessimistic and just, oh, same old Browns. But I mean, and you're right. I think every friend circle or group, or you go in that stadium and on game day, and you're going to have a little bit of both. You know, you're going to have the people that leave it in the third quarter that have seen enough, and other people that are going to, you know, stick by. You know, it is fascinating. You're so right about that.
Yeah, and I wonder how other fan bases are, right? I mean, I've been in this Cleveland bubble. You know, I spent 4 years in Chicago, and I got a little bit of that Chicago vibe, but they're also winning championships with Michael Jordan. So, you know, you get it balanced out the Cubs failures. But, you know, like, dude, just I'm picking a random city, right? My uncle lives in Denver. Like, what's the vibe in Denver? Although Denver's had success, right? I mean, the Broncos have won Super Bowls. Like, I'd just be curious, and it probably is completely related to the success of your teams, right? And just the optimism and confidence. I would guess there's a direct link there, but it'd be interesting. You know, is it based also on what the weather's like? And, you know, like, right, there's no doubt Cleveland has some kind of inferiority complex, right? Like, so that I would assume that weighs into this whole mindset, right? If you live in San Diego, maybe you didn't give a crap that your teams are bad because you live in San Diego and the weather's gorgeous every day, right? Like, so maybe it didn't get in your head. So I just think it's, you know, Buffalo would probably be a good example too. But I just think it's really an interesting thing. And I get the harsh reaction, because Thornhill was greeted with, it was mixed on Twitter. The reaction to him was mixed. But there are some people that were adamant about, hey, you can't understand, right? Like, prove it to us. And I kind of completely understand that from the Browns fan base.
Wow. Twitter is a pretty negative place.
Oh, so. That's a good point, Judd. That's a good point.
Yeah, right. One last point on that with the fans, though, is what's incredible, and we know, listen, Browns fans are the best fans in the NFL with what we've been through, what they've been through, and the fact that they keep coming back, and the Browns backers, and how many fans travel. It's incredible. Right. I mean, but then what's funny about it, though, is you only have a certain amount of games a year at home, and then the stadium's empty half the time by the third quarter. they don't show up at all. It's just, it's crazy. You would think that every seat would be packed from the minute the game started until it ended, when you have so few of them. But I get it. You know, a lot of, you know, when you lose so many games and you have, but I guess my point is that how much following they have all year long. Like, people listen to this podcast right here, and people spend all this time following the Browns and giving their opinions. And then you just have those, you know, 8 or 9 home games, and you see the empty seats.
No, that's a great point, Chud, because you're right. That interest level is so high nonstop. And to me, it feels like a fear of rejection. Like, they're afraid to open their hearts because all they've done is had their heart broken time and time again. So I think Browns fans are guarded now, and they're not going to get overly, not every Browns fan, because there are some that just jump in full bore, and God bless them. But I think I venture to guess the majority go and guard it. Like, hey, I'm going to open myself up, but if we lose or if we're losing, I'm going to close it back down, right? So you don't hurt me too badly. Like, that's how I feel with Browns fans. And I like to play amateur psychologist, so I could be completely wrong, but that's my sense on it. I think the only other thing on the OTAs I want to talk about, Chud, real quick, is Elijah Moore, for, you know, the receiver. You get to see him in person. We didn't see, you know, I'm watching him, and it's tough. You know, they're not going full speed a bunch. But I thought it was interesting. He talked about Deshaun Watson and said what stands out to him the most is his love of football. And, you know, they went on that trip to Puerto Rico, and he said it was hard to get Watson out of the playbook. So, you know, I thought that was interesting. Obviously, this whole season, so much of this season is about Deshaun Watson, and we'll talk about him down the road. And we got OTA practice next week. Then we get 3 days of minicamp, and we can kind of talk about where Deshaun Watson looks, right? I watched him this week. You know, you see good and bad. There were some deep throws missed. Like, I saw a bunch of deep shots, which I like. Not all of them were completed, which was tough. You know, like, if you're kind of, you know, if you're watching, it's like, okay, took a bunch of deep shots. They didn't complete as many deep shots as they probably should have. But he said the love of the game in his playbook all the time. I thought that was interesting. And then we talked to tight end Jordan Akins, who played with Watson with the Texans, and he's going to be the number two tight end. And he was saying, hey, when he watched Watson play last year, that he really thought the footwork was something that was different. Like, we talk about Watson's struggles a year ago, and he contributed a lot of those to Watson's footwork not being where it was in 2020, right? When he had so much success with the Texans, he blamed it on footwork, the rust. And I just thought that was interesting, because we talked so much about why was there rust, and it's getting comfortable in the pocket. And I think that's probably tied into the footwork too. But Akin said that's where he noticed a difference and a fall off in Watson's performance. So it'll be interesting to see how that gets cleaned up through OTAs, through minicamp, in training camp, and if Watson is back fundamentally where he was in 2020, when he was a Pro Bowler, led the league in passing and all those stats, and where the Browns need him to be if they're going to compete in the AFC North and the just loaded AFC.
Scott, do you think there'll come a point where Elijah Moore will end up being the top receiver on this team?
It's an interesting question, Chud. If you look at the contract situations, I think you can see that. You can project that. I don't think it'll happen this year, because I think Amari Cooper's still really good. And I think he had, if not his best, one of his best seasons in his NFL career. But Moore's younger. Cooper's got a giant contract, right? It's 20 plus million. You know, Don Peoples-Jones is in the last year of his rookie contract. So I don't think it's crazy to think that you could enter next year with Moore as your number one. I don't know if I project that right now, because I think if Cooper plays at a high level, he's worth what you're paying him. But I don't think it's outlandish to think that that could happen. If not 2024, 2025, you know, depending on, do they extend Moore, because he's got 2 years left on his rookie contract. But yeah, I think the Browns really see a bright future for him. And when you talk about, can this offense take a jump? So much of that, in my mind, is about Elijah Moore and his impact on that receiving core in the passing game.
Last thing we got for you, new rule change in the NFL.
Yeah, the kickoff, right? So now, you know, the league has been trying to take the kickoff out of the game, or at least that might be too harsh. Reducing the possibility of injuries on kickoffs, because it's such – the research shows that there's more concussions on kickoffs, and the league obviously has liability. There's been the concussion lawsuits. So we've seen the touchback, where now it goes to the 25. They kick off from 35 rather than 30 to promote touchbacks. And now the rule that's going to be in effect for at least 2023, and we've seen it in college. It's been in college in the last, I don't know, handful of years, where you can call a fair catch from anywhere inside the 25. So if there's a high kick, you catch it at the 1 yard line, you can call a fair catch, and it's like a touchback. The ball goes to the 25. You know, the league says it's to reduce concussions. Special teams coaches were unanimous that they didn't like the rule. It feels like it's a step toward no more kickoffs, right? So it's going to be interesting. How do coaches react? Because the special teams coach, it's their job to not just give the ball to 25, right? You can do that. You can have your kicker kick through the end zone all day long, and the ball goes to the 25. And you'll do that against, like, elite returners, right? You don't want the ball in, you know, Cordell Patterson's hands, so you kick it through the end zone. But if you think you got good coverage teams and you can float it up to the 2-yard line and go cover a guy and stop him at the 20, those 5 yards are huge, right? Like, that's where you win on the margins. And if everybody just starts at the 25, that's one less phase where special teams has an impact. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of the reason the special teams coaches are so opposed to it. We're going to talk to Bubba Ventrone next week. We'll talk to the coordinators. I'm fascinated to hear what he has to say about it. But yeah, I think it's somewhat significant rule. I think it's going to have a huge impact on the kicking game. You know, does it hugely bother me? No. I like all rules that try to help player safety, and this feels like it's going to do that. I don't know if the motivation behind it is correct, but if it does reduce concussions, I'm all for that. But it's certainly a change in the game.
All right, that's it for me, Scott. I'm going to head out here to a nice 3-day weekend, and I hope you enjoy yours, and everyone out there have a great Memorial Day weekend, the unofficial start to summer.
Yeah, thanks, Chad. I hope people have time to listen to this over their 3-day weekend. By now, it's too late because they would already listen to it, but I hope people get time to listen to it on the way to a cookout or the golf course or wherever. So thank you for doing this, Chad, and we had more OTAs next week, so hopefully we'll do this again. Thanks a lot. Thanks for listening to Zone Coverage, and you can read all my work at brownzone.com. Thanks.